Hello, I'm Diane Lowther from Brilliant Minds, and my guest in this session is Shelley Rose Charvet, known to many of our listeners as the writer of the excellent book Words That Change Minds, and also the author of the Language and Behaviour, or LAB, profile. Hello, Shelley.
Hello, Diane. First of all, I have to correct you on one thing. Roger Bailey developed the LAB profile originally, and I'm basically known for developing a lot of the applications associated with it. So we have to give Roger some credit for actually developing the model.
Mm-hmm. Apologies to Roger. But certainly you have been responsible for lots of people becoming aware of the LAB profile, and I guess that's one of the things that people think of when they hear your name.
Absolutely.
So to begin with, Shelley, would you tell us how you got started with NLP in the first place? Because you first started learning NLP a long time ago, didn't you?
I did. It was in 1983, and I was living in Paris, France, working as a communication trainer around France and in a couple of other European countries, working for a small training company. And my boss came in one day, and he said, I've just heard about this NLP thing, and we went to an evening seminar to find out what it was. And a therapist had come back from training with John Grinder. She'd taken, I think, an NLP practitioner, which, you know, was in its very rudimentary forms in those days.
Yeah.
And we took one look at this, and both of us were absolutely hooked immediately.
What was it that you saw in that evening?
Well, what it was about was understanding how people behaved and what motivated them and what had them do what they do outside of their conscious awareness. And so right at the very beginning, we could see that this was the most powerful level to communicate with people at.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, everyone has the experience of trying to change your behavior or trying to accomplish a goal or solve a problem through sheer willpower and force of personality. And there's only so long you can keep that up, even if you're sort of dramatic and powerful in your own right. Willpower, conscious level willpower, I believe is very limited. And so we were absolutely fascinated by the fact that there was this unconscious mind and that you could communicate with this. And you could communicate with your own unconscious mind as well as other people's. So my boss and I, we signed up for the second ever practitioner that was ever given in France in 1983.
Wow. And so back then, when you first started learning NLP, what was it that then kind of encouraged you to carry on learning? Now, were you getting good results with what you were learning straight away?
Well, it was very funny because I'm an experimental sort of person. You know, I don't necessarily buy into everything right away. I got excited about it, but I wanted to see if it worked.
Yeah.
And when we learned a rapport, so that is listening to people's keywords and their criteria, matching their behavior, and listening to their language and watching their eye movements to see if they were more visual, auditory, kinesthetic. I thought, this is perfect. I'm going to the CERN, which is one of my clients, it still is today, and I have 16 interviews to do in a day. You can see I was extremely young and naive because I thought it was possible to do 16 interviews in one day.
Yeah.
And
that is ambitious.
It was ambitious. Had a half an hour per person with like 5 minutes in between. And what I did was do all the rapport pieces and then test for rapport. And, of course, as you know, the way you test for rapport is you shift something. So I matched my interviewees on all these levels, and then I would shift and see if they followed me. Well, nothing worked in the morning. And I went, oh, this is crap. I mean, they said it worked, but it doesn't work. And I thought, but Shelley, maybe you're just writing this off too soon. Maybe it's a question of skill as opposed to just doing, you know, doing something for a first time without really knowing what you're doing. And I went away and had lunch and came back in the afternoon. And every single time I tested it in the afternoon, people shifted with me. And I noticed the intimacy of the conversation and the depth of the conversation increased enormously. And this was way back then. And I thought, there is a skill to be learned here.
Yep.
And it's very powerful. And it's empirical. That means you can't just make up stuff about people and then have other people believe it's true. There's actually a mechanism by which you can test what you're doing to see if it's appropriate. And that was one of the things that just got me hooked and kept me hooked. And the other thing was, it's a very individualizable model. So you're taught kind of generic strategies, but you're also taught, and you can also learn, how to adapt them for whole groups or specific individuals. Because for once in your life, people don't just say you should listen to people. You actually are given a model of what to listen for. So those are a number of the reasons that I was inspired to just keep learning it. And as I started integrating it, I began to integrate it into the programs I was running in mediation and conflict resolution and negotiation. And in the 80s, we were doing assertiveness training. That was a big deal as well. Mm. So I started to integrate it immediately.
So in those early days then, when you were first using NLP, what sort of problems were you able to solve using an NLP approach or an NLP style of thinking and behaving?
The kinds of things that I noticed most people were doing at that time tended to have a therapeutic kind of background. So a number of the skills that were being taught in generally NLP were how to de-traumatize a phobia, which is a very useful process to do. It wasn't quite as useful in a business setting.
Right.
And there was lots of other processes that were mainly therapeutic. But what I discovered is some of the processes were really easily adaptable to the business setting. So, for example, in sales and marketing, the ability to establish rapport and find out what was important to your client is really important in sales and marketing. It's also really important in interviewing for human resources people. I also noticed that some of the techniques, there's a technique that at the practitioner level that's called negotiating between parts. Now, it's normally been taught as how to help somebody negotiate through the conflicts they have inside themselves.
Yeah.
But I applied the structure to mediation and negotiating between people and noticed that the results were quite incredible there because you really were honoring each other's differences and bringing people to a higher level where they realized there were some goals they had in common even if their methods were different. And in the case where they had goals that seemed to be in conflict, you could at least, using these techniques, very quickly identify why it would be in each person's best interest from their point of view to come to an agreement, which makes negotiation much more motivating and satisfactory because people are more motivated to come to a solution and not motivated to stonewall or just have the whole thing break down.
Mm. So that must have been quite a radical development for you when you discovered that.
Well, it was just, absolutely, it was just lights coming on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it leads you to the question, well, what else can you do with this? What else can you do with this, right? Which is an eternal search.
Mm-hmm. So over the years then, how has it changed for you? What are the differences now in what you see people applying NLP skills to and the results that they're getting?
There's so many different areas that NLP is applied to. Educating children, educating adults, personal development, business development, recruiting is now has become a science rather than an art.
Mm-hmm.
And NLP has contributed a big way to that. The lab profile and some of the online lab profile-based tools are a big key in how we have adjusted our thinking about how we hire and maintain people. Managing people in terms of helping them develop their potential and have them use their potential at work. Stress management, and I think there's a lot more work to do in stress management as people are going through, you know, different kinds of crises either in their lives or societal upheavals. I think that NLP could be used as a better teaching tool to help people manage their lives and have happier, more productive lives or whatever is important to them.
Absolutely. Now, for the benefit of people who are not familiar with the lab profile, would you just tell us a little bit more about the lab profile and what it can be used for?
Certainly. The lab profile is actually a short form for the language and behavior profile. And what that is all about is when you listen to somebody's language and you're able to decode it, you can understand, predict, and influence somebody's behavior. So it is a whole new way of listening to how people talk or eliciting information from them that's used for, in business, it's used for marketing and advertising campaigns. Mm-hmm. It's used for sales. It's used as a recruitment tool because it's based on uncovering two kinds of patterns. The patterns that are all about how someone gets motivated and what they need to be motivated, and that's really useful for sales as well as recruitment and management. And then the second set of patterns are more about internal processing. So that's how people think, the strategies they go through, how they pay attention to information, how they respond to stress, what kind of environments are they more productive in, and what are the sequences they go through when they create rules for themselves or when they get convinced about something. And so I teach people both of those sets of patterns to use in a number of different challenges. And most of the time I work in business organizations or at work. So they're not always business organizations, but they're when people are at work, those kinds of applications.
Now, that sounds like an awful lot of information. And I guess some of our listeners might be thinking, you know, that it would take a long time to understand all of those different things about someone.
Well, and there's a couple problems with the lab profile, and I think we need to look at that right up front. It's a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, a skill needs to be learned. You know, just like my experience with the establishing of rapport, you have to practice something in order to develop some skill at it. The good news, of course, is that if you want to learn how to listen for these patterns, there's a very clear and relatively simple methodology. You ask a certain set of questions, you look at the answers, and there's a grid for decoding them, mm-hmm. and then you test them. I mean, one of the things that I think is really important is that whole empirical side. So you test them by using certain words and phrases with your client or your employee, whoever you're doing it with, and you'll know exactly if you're on or off.
Based on their responses.
So clear methodology, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how long typically would it take you to profile someone using the lab profile?
It can take anywhere from about 12 to 14 minutes to about 40 minutes, mm-hmm. and it depends on how much information they give you. If they're more of a general, in a general mode, which is big picture, just get to the point,
mm-hmm.
or if they're in a more detail-oriented mode. And
which presumably would then take a bit longer.
It takes a bit longer. And in fact, if you time the interviews, you'll have a really good handle on that particular pattern, which, you know, people would be surprised at this. Whether you're detail-oriented or prefer a big picture, let's say when you're at work, has a lot to do with who you communicate with well and where your conflicts are likely to be. And I know that's surprising to people. But if you think about, in your own experience, when someone has taken 20 minutes to say hello when you just want to get on with what you're supposed to be doing, or if somebody floods you with too many details, or if somebody doesn't give you enough information and you have no clue what's going on, how angry that makes people.
Yes, and we've all had that experience.
Yeah, and so, you know, people don't think that whether you're in a specific or a general mode, whether that influences your communication, but it's a big piece in communication.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So can you tell us some of the success stories of your work using the lab profile?
Well, one of the things that and this is so much fun, one of the things we get to do is we get called into companies to help them understand their customers better. So what will motivate their customers to be interested? Maybe one set of patterns, but then what would motivate them to make a buying decision would be another set of patterns. And recently I worked with a large software company and we decoded the buying steps for enterprise software into a number of these triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And when they are writing their marketing materials, they're getting a much better response rate because they're matching the phase of the buying decision that the typical corporate buyer of different kinds of enterprise software is at. So that's been a huge success story. Another success story has been in actually bargaining. One of the things I do is help people and teach them and prepare them for high-stakes negotiations, for example, bargaining. And you know, one of the toughest situations in North America is to deal with United Auto workers and employers between the auto workers, et cetera. And there's a lot of things at stake. And, you know, the auto industry has been through a huge upheaval. It's taken them a long time to get back on their feet. But a couple years prior to some of the upheavals that have happened, I worked with an organization, and there was a threat of a walkout. And this is in an era where companies had just instituted just-in-time shipping. So there's no inventories in stock. So
yeah.
The management team had no inventory basically, and they were afraid the union was going to walk. And they asked me to prepare their negotiation team, and I used both NLP with them, adapted to negotiation, plus the lab profile. And not only, and this was a really tough negotiation, and not only did they get an agreement, they got the first five-year agreement in the history of the company.
Wow.
And the challenge was the people they were negotiating with, so the UAW, United Auto Workers, negotiation team, they were not very well respected by the membership. So the challenge was to talk through the union members, the union representatives, to actually have the union members listen. And a lot of people have this kind of communication challenge. I call it a second-order communication challenge, where I get to talk to you, but you're not the decision-maker.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else is a decision-maker. So I have to speak to you with your patterns and figure out what's motivating for you and where, you know, how can I increase my impact with you and get you to use the patterns of this other group of people when you speak to them if I don't have direct access. And this is one of the things we can teach people how to do. Now, that's challenging. It's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the things that both NLP and the lab profile can enable you to do.
Right. So I guess over the years that you've been working with the lab profile, you must have developed lots of different applications for it. It sounds as if it's one of those tools that has lots of different facets to it that can be applied in different arenas.
Absolutely. The coaching community is very, very interested in the lab profile, and I've spoken at a number of international coaching conferences.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, I developed the lab profile coaching methodology, which is a very particular way of structuring a coaching conversation. You know, I figure that the vast majority of coaching happens outside of an official coaching session. You know, when somebody comes up to you and says, by the way, have you got a couple minutes, or can I talk to you about something, or
mm-hmm.
The classic is, I'm having a little problem, which, as you know, is never a little problem, and I figured that we needed a methodology that was informal but yet structured enough to help somebody reach their goals and solve their problems, and I call it the lab profile conversational coaching methodology, and it's about listening to the motivation patterns that are in the person's description of the problem,
mm-hmm.
listening to the motivation patterns that are in their description of the outcome of what they want instead, and then helping them shift from the first set of patterns into the second set of patterns so that they can then develop their own solution for meeting their outcome.
Right. Can you give an example of that?
Well, yes. For example, let's say someone is in their problem state, they're not getting along with people, like they're
mm-hmm.
having an issue. And when you ask them questions about with their outcome and what's been going on, you find out that in their problem, they're what's very called internal.
Mm-hmm.
So they decide for themselves what's good, bad, right, wrong. Now, that's a perfectly fine pattern, but if you're trying to improve communication, now and then it'd be nice to peek outside and go a little bit more external and take on board what other people say are important. You know, if you think of relationships at work or personal relationships, for example. And so let's say, and usually there's quite a few patterns, but we're just going to take this one.
Okay.
So let's say that in their solution, in their outcome, they are actually having good dialogue with people and working well with them. And if I listen to them and ask them how they know that they were having good dialogue, the indicator might be external. Like the other person would give me feedback and smile at me, and they would tell me that they're happy. That's a very external indicator. You know, an internal indicator would go, well, I feel that the communication went well.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pick up those differences. Well, so what you would do then is sort of summarize the problem as it has been for the person,
mm-hmm.
using internal language, so you feel that it hasn't been as easy as you thought it should be,
yeah.
and then gradually overlap into just using the patterns and getting that person to follow you, at least into switching the patterns. And so you would overlap and end up saying something like, and so when things are going well, that's, you know, that because you're getting lots of smiles and maybe pats on the back, and this person is really coming closer to you and spending more time with you and being complimentary to you. And see, what you're doing is you're shifting them into their outcome mode.
Mm-hmm. So
and then you help them come up with a solution from that mode.
Mm-hmm.
And what the lab profile does, and it's a messy process, it's like a conversation, but there's a structure to it. And I think what's good for coaches is there's a methodology that you can follow that shows you what to listen for first and what to do next.
Yes.
Without prescribing the solution. And, you know, coaches are very into actually asking questions.
Yes.
So that
yes.
would be one example.
Mm. That's really good. I can see how that would be really useful in sort of in the just day-to-day business environment where, as you say, people don't necessarily have a formal coaching session planned, but they do need a bit of input and some guidance and somebody to listen.
That's right.
And ask good questions.
Conversational, that's right. And
yeah.
this will help you guide you in what kind of questions you're
mm-hmm.
asking.
Mm.
And I have a whole program called conversational coaching with the lab profile to teach people that particular thing. I also, one of the things that I've been doing for a while is the Lab Profile Consultant Trainer Certification Program. And there we take people through all the business skills you need to use the lab profile in business. So, for example, using words to attract clients, recruiting and mentoring and retaining staff, team building, sales and marketing, coaching. So it's a whole program designed to use the lab profile in these advanced ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it also enables you to become certified to train the lab profile to other people. And we now have two programs, in fact, because we have an applied an advanced business applications diploma. It's a 5-day program, and I have a 10-day program where you get certified to train other people.
Right. So is that... Is that kind of a complete event? You know, could someone come with very little knowledge of the lab profile and work through that and at the end of 10 days would feel very confident to use it?
My preference is that they actually spend some time learning the lab profile because it's a heck of a lot to catch up on in 10 days. And there are a number of programs available. There's a number of trainers around the planet who are certified to teach lab profile practitioner programs and lab profile mm-hmm. master practitioner programs. And I highly recommend doing the lab profile practitioner at the very least and then practicing doing these questions as many times as possible. And, of course, we give people guidance on how to do that so that they're ready when they come.
Right.
And this year, for the very first time in 2009, and we'll be offering we're offering a master trainer program to actually look at some of these more sophisticated problems, like I was just mentioning, in terms of doing the high-stakes negotiation, doing the decoding of motivation triggers in the buying public when you've identified a target market, advanced facilitation of groups. For example, how do you get, when you're running a meeting, how do you make sure everybody stays on topic and is engaged? Because most people who are in meetings, if you look around the room, you'll notice that a good chunk of the time, people are not actually in the room.
Yes.
So if you need to have people in the room, how do you facilitate things in such a way that you keep them engaged and motivated?
Mm-hmm. Mm. So for people who already have some familiarity with the lab profile and perhaps even have done the trainer's training, there's a really strong message there that it doesn't end with your trainer's training. There are still more advanced applications.
Well, we've been doing the trainer's training and honing this program since 1998. Well, my learning has just taken on a whole new set of areas, and I would hate to be the only person on the planet that uses these particular uses. When I think the potential for communication and understanding is really quite incredible. I mean, we've had a number of people come on these courses who do international mediations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this, because of the power of these tools, you can apply them to understanding different cultures and influencing different situations that, you know, there's a cross-cultural component as well. So I wax enthusiastic about this. I think... that one of the great things about the tools, you test it. Like everything you think is going on, you need to test. And I really like what I call having a rigorous scientific and empirical methodology.
Right. So it's not guesswork. It really is grounded in real practical evidence.
Absolutely.
That what you're doing is on the right track and is working. Yeah. Mm. So what else are you doing with NLP and with the lab profile now, Shelley?
I am developing some distance learning programs now because that's the way people are going. I realize that people are very busy and it's difficult to get away for a certain amount of time, and people want to keep learning and they need it in smaller chunks. So I'm in the process of developing an online lab profile practitioner program, and we'll be doing some other remote learning things because people have said, well, are you coming to my area and around the planet? And I'm not going to everybody's area. And I think this is the best way to be able to get people to continue learning. And, of course, my bias is I think being there in person and getting feedback on the spot is the best way to go in terms of learning interpersonal skills. But you can't always be there. So I think we need some alternatives to give to people.
Right, yes. And I believe you have a new book coming out too.
I have a new book.
Tell us about that.
I'm not excited about this book at all. Au contraire. This book I've been working on for quite a while, and I'm happy to say it's ready now. It's called The Customer is Bothering Me, How to Change Attitudes, Improve Results, and Grow Your Bottom Line. And this is an advanced lab profile book for business. But, I mean, it's for organizations, period. There's also a number of healthcare examples in how to use a lab profile. And it's designed for managers and leaders, particularly, who are responsible for what their clients or their customers experience when they do business with them. So it's about how you attract and treat your customers. It's about how you deal with issues. It's about setting up your customer philosophy so that things work as a matter of course, and your whole organization, in terms of dealing with customers, just rolls from there.
So how did you come up with that title, The Customer is Bothering Me?
This is actually a little bit of chutzpah being that Yiddish word for the nerve.
Mm-hmm.
From my experience of living and working in a number of different countries, it occurred to me that different cultures have different philosophies of how they treat customers. And in the 80s, I lived in France, and I think largely it's still the same. There's a French customer service philosophy, and that is the customer is always wrong. And, yeah, I think things are a bit better. I mean, the SNCF, the train company, has done a bit better. I noticed from my travels around there, and I'm not always wrong or treated like an idiot. And then at the end of the 80s, I came home to Canada, and I work all over the place still, but I noticed, having been away and then coming back to a culture that I had known quite well, it occurred to me that there was an underlying customer philosophy in Canada, and that is the customer is bothering me. Now, you can test for this. You know how I like empirical things.
Yes.
And the easiest way to test for this is to ask somebody to do something slightly outside their normal procedure and watch the response. Well, if you do that in Canada, people sigh and they go, all right. Or, you know, they moan and whine for a while, but et cetera. So I've noticed that this is really quite true to this culture here. There's also an American customer service philosophy. And again, these are generalizations. You can see exceptions. But and in the case of America, and I believe that the customer philosophy has to do more with a belief about the nature of the customer. The customer is a spaced-out preschooler who will not listen. And so this is why they treat you this way, as if you can't figure it out for yourself. I remember quite a few years ago, I took my kids to Disney in Florida, and we were on the little monorail, and the little voice came over and said, told us to hold on, like we'd never been on a train before.
Yes.
This is why waiters in restaurants explain to you that they're your waiter.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As if you didn't quite get it. And one of the things I've got in the book is, how do you determine what is your customer philosophy in your organization? So there's a number of questions you can ask. Like, for example, one of the things you want to know is, who's more important in your organization, your customers or you? And the easiest way to determine that is to look at your staff's behavior. So if your staff is making people wait before they acknowledge them until they are ready to deal with the customer, then clearly they believe what they're doing is more important.
Yes.
Whereas if somebody who's serving customers stops what they're doing and signals to a waiting customer that they'll be with them in a moment, clearly that person is, the customer is more important. So there's a number of questions you can ask that. Like, what are the employees' behaviors with the customers?
Mm-hmm.
What must these employees believe to be true to behave this way? And if there were a philosophy or a set of beliefs or values driving this behavior, what would it be? And so I've taken people through a number of examples to look at that so that they can actually identify what are some of the operational beliefs, values, and rules.
Okay. So then when you found that out, what then?
That gives you your starting point.
Mm-hmm.
I've also talked about why customers get angry. You know, many organizations blame the customer because the customer is more difficult.
Yeah.
And they call it customer rage. And I think what has happened instead, it's not really customer rage at all. I think I like to call it customer outrage. And what has actually happened here is people's lab profile patterns have shifted. This is the great customer attitude shift. You see, back in the old days, we were prepared to do what we were told to do. You know, line up over here, fill out this form, pay this much interest. And now those days are gone. So instead of being very reactive and being willing to be told what to do, we now tell our suppliers what we want from them. When in many countries, well, Canada particularly, for example, the cost of mobile phone service is outrageous. And most people will describe themselves as if they feel like they're a prisoner of their mobile phone company. That's the relationship they have, also with their banks. Many people feel like they're a prisoner of their banks. The banks dictate to them. And, of course, what happens, and you can measure this, is people phone up the call centers and blow up because they're so unhappy.
Yes.
And the reason they're unhappy is they don't think their suppliers should dictate to them. Customers have shifted. The great customer attitude shift has happened, and people are no longer as compliant as they used to be. They want choices that suit them, not the supplier. And they won't put up with many things. Insurance companies are used to dictating what will happen to their customers. Well, customers don't want to stand for that anymore. So the next step is really understanding what that shift is and then developing your customer philosophy, because you want to be able to do more business with your customer, raise your sales, as well as give your customers the kind of experience that creates customer loyalty and gets them to refer other people. And then what we do is that we look at the lab profile of what is a normal transaction with a customer in sales or service and what is a problem transaction. Because all the pattern shifts. You know, when something goes wrong, people's lab profile patterns shift. So I've developed two sets of four-part processes that organizations can adapt to their structure to ensure that the experience they give prospective customers as well as actual customers matches the customer's need from the customer's point of view.
Right. So what you're saying, I think, is that the patterns that someone uses may vary quite significantly in the course of a normal working day, and that in some transactions, the ones that go well, they'll be using different patterns of language and behavior than they will in transactions where they're not getting good results.
Absolutely, and that sounds really complicated to deal with, and most organizations don't deal with it well because they don't shift their behavior when the customer shifts their behavior. And so what I've done is develop a step-by-step process by which you can identify what's going on and have the answer at hand. And this saves will save organizations a ton of money because they'll know what to train people on, and they'll have a system that works. So they'll avoid lots of escalations and other kinds of problems. As well as increasing their sales. So that's what this book is about. So it's taking the lab profile and NLP to a whole new level.
That sounds fascinating. So this is obviously very new material, but I'm guessing from what you've already told us about your liking for testing things that you must have already tested this out in some organizational environments.
Well, and there's tons of stories in there about how this has worked and how we've used this so that you can actually see examples of that. And made it as step-by-step as possible so people can see all the different ways that they can use this.
That sounds excellent. And so when is the book going to be available?
It's available right now. And if people want to go to thecustomerisbotheringme.com, they can get either an till the end of 2009, they can get an e-copy, and as of mid-January 2010, it will be available as a softcover book, so they'll have a choice there.
Excellent. Thank you for that. So if the book's about to be published or has in fact been published, then what's next for you?
I don't know. I think I'm going to celebrate for a few minutes.
That sounds like a good plan. It sounds like you've been very busy.
I sounded like I was bragging about the book, and I'm sorry about this, but it's a bit like birthing a baby, except at least when you give birth to a baby, you know, this is an analogy particularly for women, is once you've started the labor process, you have a rough idea that within a day or so you're getting a baby. Well, with the book, it's not quite the same. So you think you're ready, and then something else happens, and nope, the baby ain't here yet. So,
So how long did it take to produce the book?
I don't want to tell you because it's embarrassing. So you could read into that a long time.
Okay.
So I was busy not adding to the book and not working on it for quite some time, and I had to decide that the book was going to be finished and then make that happen.
And has the upheaval in the world's economies made a difference to the sorts of organizations you're working with and their views of their relationship with customers?
You know, it's really interesting. Because I get to work with a number of organizations, in this last economic upheaval that we've been going through, and a number of countries have come out of it sooner than others, and then for... You know, it's different for individual people as it is than it is for businesses and what sector they're in, the financial sector, the car sector, et cetera. And I work in both of those areas, as well as many others. I've noticed three attitudes amongst the business leaders that I've been working with. And the first attitude is what I call mental hibernation. And these are business leaders who are paralyzed in fear. And it's like they're in the cave waiting for winter to end. And you'll see, and they won't be making any decisions. The second attitude that I've seen is what I call Chicken Little, and these are people who are running around in a complete panic, cutting everything they can find.
Yeah, I've seen a few of those.
Yes, and it's frightening. And, you know, of course, everybody in the organization is now flat on the floor, you know, afraid to pick their head up, but not a lot's getting done. And then the third attitude is one I call the broadband attitude. And this is where leaders are stepping back, and they're taking a really wide view. And they're looking at the past, the present, and the future. But these are not the people who are saying, well, we've been through recessions before. These are not the people who are saying, well, we've been through global, you know, the planet's been through global warming before. So these are not people that are looking for what's similar between what happened in the past. These are people who are going, oh, this is different than before. And they're looking at trends, and they're looking at what's happening, and they're both preparing for the future as well as looking at what they need to do to get through the present. And this is why I call it the broadband view. And I think that if you're not having a rethink as a result of what's going on, this is like, you know, shooting in the dark. This is like jumping off a cliff and hoping that maybe you brought a parachute, because things are changing. And I think we need to be looking at trends. And I don't say this to frighten people. I say that it's an opportunity to have a rethink. And I think if we just go on with the normal procedure that we've always been using without stepping back and getting more information and becoming a bit external and saying, well, what are people saying about that? What could that mean to me? And then going back internally and saying, why would this be important to me? What do I need to do about it? What do I need to achieve or avoid? What's my short and medium term? And look at tools for actually doing some scenario planning. I think that's very important for individual people and business leaders today.
So you think that even when we get economic recovery, that the world will be a different place, that we're not going back to something that we might recognize or feel more comfortable in?
I think the tendency is to hope that that will happen. And I know that human beings have the capacity to ignore things, so that some people will think that that has happened. But I think we'd be much better prepared if we thought about what's going now in terms of what will change, as well as what might stay the same. Not everything is going to change. And how do I need to be prepared for that? For example, there's a number of intersecting driving forces. How will the degradation of the environment impact your work? How will it impact your company? How will the drive to be green impact what's going on? At some point, will people actually have to pay the true cost for the goods and services they use? And if so, how will that change their behavior? In terms of lab profile, what will motivate people to buy in the future that's different from now? Like, for example, will they be more motivated to buy when they have more choice or when it's more economic to have fewer choices? So will people be wanting to compromise more or less in your product and services? Will there be more of a demand for people to have the things they need instantaneously without having to think about things? That's where the technology seems to be going. How will that impact different kinds of businesses, different kinds of organizations? Let's take government organizations. What will people want from their governments? What will they want from their healthcare services in the future? And, of course, every country has a different healthcare model. But we all have different expectations. How much tolerance will there be for wait lists in the healthcare system?
So are you coming across leaders in organizations who are taking this broadband view and reaping the benefits from it at this stage?
Yes, and they need support because those who are doing that are surrounded by people in their organizations who are going into mental hibernation or chicken little. And because I work with a number of different organizations, I think that part of my role is to help people get to that broadband view and support them in that. And this is one of the purposes of my book, is to actually have people stand back and think about what is their philosophy, what is their customer philosophy, what is it that they actually want to do for customers. And I've given them a process for thinking that out.
Right, I see. So everything that you've told us so far, Shelley, that really underlines the fact that an understanding of other people's behavior patterns and their language patterns is relevant in so many different areas of life and also in work. Are there any other applications that you would like to see developed that so far have not yet, as far as you know, had the attention?
I think we need more research in this, and I would like to encourage people to be doing more PhDs and more master's theses using the lab profile. A number of my graduates and people who have studied the lab profile or even just read my book have approached me about doing different kinds of topics, and there is a lot to be researched. I mean, one area is gender differences. That shows up in patterns as well. I speak to groups on some of the gender values and how that shows up differently in work and what that means for people's careers, what it means for communicating with different groups. I think you could do lab profile gender research and that would be really useful.
So is there evidence then that men and women do have broadly different value sets?
I'll put it a little differently to be not quite so controversial.
Okay.
There are traditional male and traditional female value sets. And from my work today, where I work with a lot of executives, both men and women, is not all women have the traditional female model and models, plural. All men have the traditional male models. But what happens is when you find out where your own value models are and you find out where other people's are in terms of these gender models, it enables you to communicate better and to avoid stepping in some big minefields.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yes. For example, one of the big value splits in the traditional, again, I say very intentionally, the traditional male model and the traditional female model is what is the nature of life on this planet? And many men from the traditional male model will say, well, life is like a game. It's a team sport. Well, if that's the metaphor that you operate out of and that you buy into and you think is good, then you think that you can play around with a lot of things. Whereas if you believe that life is more like a traditional classroom, the rules of the classroom are different than the rules of a team sport. For example, in a classroom, if you work hard, you get rewarded with good marks on your exams, right?
Yes.
And in a game, you get rewarded for winning at whatever the cost.
Right. So in the business
and in
context,
so cheating's not such a bad thing in a game, but if you're, you know, right, if you get away with it, all the better.
Yep.
But if you are operating out of the life is like a traditional schoolroom, well, cheating's a disgrace. Failure's a disgrace.
Right.
And so it has impacts on how you communicate. And what I teach people to do is how to recognize their own and other people's values models, and then how to solve problems or how to communicate with people who have different models, and not just to write them off as you're a woman, therefore you have this, you're a man, therefore you have this. And I think there's some research, more research that needs to be done in that field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds very interesting. But
yes, if I weren't busy earning a living, I'd be off doing a bunch of research. That's
Well, let's hope that there's someone listening who will pick up that particular ball and run with it for you.
And have them contact me. I'd love to talk to them about this. So.
Okay. Shelley, we're just about out of time. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for letting me go on and on, Diane.
Would you just remind people where they can get information about your new book if they would like to?
They can come at that. They can get the information on the new book from thecustomerisbotheringme.com or from my website, wordsthatchangeminds.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you, Shelley, for your time. It's been
great
talking with you.
Thank you, Diane.